So I'd like to start by welcoming everybody to Dhammaloka for this afternoon, Christmas afternoon. So, and I think what better present to give ourselves than contemplating studying a sutta from the Buddha on Christmas Day. A very good present, I think. And my name is Venerable Nisarana. I'm one of the monks from Serpentine. Though I'm now living in Sri Lanka, I lived in Serpentine at Bodhinyana Buddhist Monastery for 9.5 years. And this is Venerable Chunda, who is currently living at Bodhinyana Monastery. So this afternoon, I'll start first of all with Namo Tassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Good. So this afternoon, I was continuing the theme of this weekend, which has been giving and generosity. On Friday night, I spoke about giving, particularly as it's very relevant at this time of year when we have Christmas, and there is much giving that's probably happened already today and continuing. And also, I spoke on Saturday about generosity because, and in Pali language, that's chaga, because generosity is something that we do, but we often don't appreciate. And the Buddha was encouraging us to actually contemplate our generosity and to use it as a source of inspiration for our practice, particularly for our meditation practice, so that we do value it and we use it to develop samadhi, concentration, and then to develop wisdom from that samadhi. So this afternoon I'm continuing that trend by discussing the Dakini Vibhanga Sutta. The Dakini Vibhanga Sutta is Majjhima Nikaya 142, and it appears on page 1102 of the middle length discourses. And as I go along, we can, if questions come up, please raise your hand and we can discuss it this afternoon too. This is evidently appearing live on the internet. I hope they're able to get it so that they don't have to get a few minutes and then wait for it to catch up, as I've seen before in the past with live streaming. So we may even have questions from overseas. So we begin the sutta, the exposition of offerings, the Dakini Vibhanga Sutta. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at Kapilavastu in Nigrodha's park. And most people, I think, will know Kapilavastu is the home of was the home of the Bodhisattva, the Buddha, before he was enlightened. And then Nigrodha Park, just outside the city. Then Mahaprajapati Gotami took a new pair of cloths and went to the Blessed One. And do people know who Mahaprajapati Gotami is? Yeah, I think most people do, but I'll just say in brief. It was the Bodhisattva's stepmother. After his mother, the queen Mahamaya, had passed away 1 week after his birth, he was brought up and fostered by his stepmother, Mahaprajapati Gotami. And she was actually the sister of his mother. So, but she looked after him like her own son and fostered him. So she had a very close relationship to him. And it's an interesting what happens in this sutta, we'll see. After paying homage to him, she sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, this new pair of cloths has been spun by me, woven by me, especially for the Blessed One. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One accept it from me out of compassion." When this was said, the Blessed One told her, "Give it to the Sangha, Gotami. When you give it to the Sangha, the offering will be made both to me and the Sangha." A second time and a third time, she said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, accept it from me out of compassion." And it's interesting, isn't it, that she was really determined to give it, but the Buddha wouldn't accept it just as an individual gift. And we can only count, we can only speculate why that could be the case. It may be that, you know, he could see attachment, he could see her attachment to himself, having been a foster son, having been a son of hers. And so maybe he could see that attachment. That's what I think of when I read this, actually, and was trying to reduce that attachment in a wholesome way, but also pointing out that, of course, that a gift to the Sangha is far greater merit than to an individual, even if that individual is the Buddha. Why is it more merit to give to a Sangha than to an individual, even if it is the Buddha? It's a good question why that would be the case. I think, you know, the Buddha, as far as I know, the Buddha didn't explain exactly why that would be the case. But when you give it to the Sangha, you're giving it to the Sangha, particularly of the present and to come. So it's sort of like increasing in merit all the time. The Buddha, when he passed away into Parinirvana, that merit that accrued from there had finished. That's how I would understand it. But if you give it to the Sangha, it continues, particularly something like a kuti, isn't it, a hut. If you give that, that will be used by many, many monks, many nuns can use it. And some of them will become arahants, and some will attain jhanas, some will attain insight. So I think that's how I understand why it's more merit to give to the Sangha. A second and a third time, the Blessed One told her, give it to the Sangha, go to me. When you give it to the Sangha, the offering will be made both to me and to the Sangha. Then the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One accept the new pair of cloths from Mahapajapati, go to me. Mahapajapati, go to me, has been very helpful to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir. As his mother, a mother's sister, she was his nurse, his foster mother, the one who gave him milk, who suckled the Blessed One when his own mother died. The Blessed One, too, has been very helpful to Mahapajapati. Go to me, Venerable Sir. It is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapajapati, go to me, has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. It is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapajapati, go to me, abstains from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from sexual misconduct and sensual pleasures, from false speech, and from wine, liquor, and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence. It is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapajapati, go to me, possesses perfect confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and that she possesses the virtues loved by the noble ones. It is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapajapati, go to me, is free from doubt about suffering, about the origin of suffering, about the cessation of suffering, and about the way leading to the cessation of suffering. The Blessed One has been very helpful to Mahapajapati, go to me. So this is quite an interesting section here, and it's of value to look at other translations of this sutta in the Chinese and in the Tibetan. And there are evidently two translations in Chinese, the Majjhima Agama, and also another individual translation. And there are other translations in Tibetan and in Sanskrit. And with this section, according to the other translations, Venerable Ananda spoke about the fact that Mahapajatami, go to me, had been a great benefit to the Bodhisattva as he grew up. But the section where it says how the Blessed One was a great benefit to, very helpful to Mahapajatami, go to me, in the other translations, that's spoken by the Buddha. Which makes sense, actually. When I read that, I thought, that makes sense. So what we have is Venerable Ananda reminding the Buddha that his stepmother, Mahapajatami, go to me, had been a great help to him, had brought him up. And then the Buddha replies, but I have also, you know, she's had great benefit from me. She's had been more than repaid, you say, because she, according to this, you know, she's become, first of all, she's taken refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, so she, and taken the five precepts, so she's become a Buddhist. She'll become a Buddhist. And the second thing that he's referring to, of course, is when he says that she has perfect confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and that she possesses the virtues loved by the noble ones. And what does this usually mean? I'm sure most people know. One's become a Sotapanna. One's got that that perfect confidence. Usually these are the qualities in the mirror of the Dhamma, they say, Buddha once said. That if a person has this, they have perfect confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma and Sangha, and they possess the virtue of loved by the noble ones. That's a sign, that's a shorthand for a stream enterer, a Sotapanna. And it continues with him saying, it is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapajatapi, Gotami, is free from doubt about suffering, about the origin of suffering, about the cessation of suffering, and about the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So this confirms, doesn't it? She has insight and knowledge. Because she's free of doubt. You know, when we talk about a Sotapanna, they usually overcome three fetters, don't they? The first three fetters. And one of those fetters is doubt. And she's free of doubt, not only about the Four Noble Truths, she's obviously free of doubt about the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. And so this is further indication that she's actually attained to the path of Sotapanna. So have you got any comments or questions about that? And what do people think of the Buddha actually reminding Ananda, replying to Ananda, that this is how he has actually benefited the Mahapajapati Gotami? Because a stream entered over... Sorry, Hugh?
No, just going back to... Mm.
I think you may have the more recent translation. This is probably 1995. Honoured, is it? Ah.
Will be honoured. So it's like they'll all be honoured. Won't be just going to the Buddha.
Yes. And
so it's more inclusive of everyone. So it's recognising the qualities of the rest of the Sangha.
Good. That's a very good point. And actually that may answer Lynn's question in part, mightn't it? That in actual fact, he's actually broadening it, because he's not saying you're not giving it to me, but you're giving it to the Sangha with myself as part of that Sangha, just changing the emphasis slightly. But I still think maybe he's pushing the attachment, you know, attachment button for her, so that, because she was obviously very keen to just give it to him alone. And when you think about it, if there's only two robes, who's you can't give it to many. Only one monk or two monks could wear it, I suppose. Yeah. So that's a good point. Thank you for that, Hugh. That's good. Yeah. Honoured. So that's nice. That's. And there's also interesting point that's brought up in the other translations, the Chinese and the Tibetan, that. One of the translations actually refers to Mahapajatami Gotami as being a nun by this time, which, when you read it, you don't get that, do you? It sounds like she's a laywoman in this, and she's offering that. Buddha's talking about the five precepts and the refuges and the fact that she's got confidence, perfect confidence. But it sounds like she's a layperson at this stage. But one of the translations actually says that she's a nun at this stage. And interestingly enough, a couple of the other translations, there are separate translations of this first part of the sutta where she's offering the robes. And in that, one of the other traditions, not Theravada tradition, includes that in the Vinaya, where they're discussing the creation of the Bhikkhuni order. So they put it in that time period. I think it would quite fit in that area too. So they're putting it in the context of, you know, Mahapajatami, go to me, requesting from the Buddha that she receive the going forth. And it would fit, I think, in that time period too. It would seem to me quite logical, actually. But, of course, not mentioned here, actually. So these comparative studies, very useful. They bring up points that are worth pondering, actually. But by and large, they agree in the main details, just details of some minor things. And then we continue with the Buddha actually saying, now, that is so, Ananda, that is so. When one person, owing to another, has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, I say that it is not easy for the former to repay the latter by paying homage to him, rising up to him, according him reverential salutation and polite services, and providing robes, alms food, resting places and medicinal requisites. So that's the going for refuge, because this is, isn't it? This is a very important part in becoming a Buddhist. It's a sort of like your orientation for, you're taking a certain orientation, a direction for your life. So taking the three refuges of Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha is actually a very important step, you know. And when a layman becomes a Samanera, a monk, they actually become a Samanera, a novice monk, once they've taken the refuges. Not that they don't even have to take the precepts straight away, but once they've taken the refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, they become a novice monk. So that is a very important first step. And then he continues, when one person, I like the way the Buddha puts here, one person, it's himself. When one person, owing to another, has come to abstain from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct in sensual pleasures, from false speech and from wine, liquor and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence, I say that it is not easy for the former to repay the latter by paying homage to him and the various offerings and medicinal requisites. And so that's very important too, because that also helps define one as a Buddhist, doesn't it? Because if we take the three refuges, yes, we're becoming Buddhists, but by taking the five precepts, we're practicing. We're really walking that path. And then it continues, when one person, owing to another, has come to possess perfect confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, and to possess the virtues loved by the noble ones, I say that it is not easy for the former to repay the latter by paying homage to him, etc., and medicinal requisites. And it's interesting because I've just said, you know, that's like when one becomes a stream enterer. So, you know, that would be an extraordinary debt, actually, that one has to another person. If they have been the cause, the words of another person have been the cause for one to become a stream enterer, to develop that perfect confidence in Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. That's a confidence that is not shaken, is it? It's sort of, it's really rock solid. There's no doubt in one's mind that the Buddha was enlightened, that the Dhamma is teaching of reality, of the way things are, and that the Sangha is practicing in accord with that. So that is an extraordinary strength, a power, and that the sila, the moral conduct of one that has got that perfect confidence is like an Aryan, like a noble one, either Sotapanna or above. The Arahants too. And then the Buddha continues, breaks it into another. When one person, owing to another, has become free from doubt about suffering, about the origin of suffering, about the cessation of suffering, and about the way leading to the cessation of suffering, I say that it is not easy for the former to repay the latter by paying homage to him and offering medicinal requisites. So it's interesting there, isn't it? He's split it into two separate things. So I would have thought, you know, that the becoming free of doubt about suffering, the origin of suffering, etc., was really what the Sotapanna has done or is doing, has done, yeah. So I would have thought that would be like a continuation of the having perfect confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma and Sangha. What do people think of that? Because it's no doubt. So in other words, have seen, you have understood. You have understood, fully understood, haven't you? If you've seen it, if there's no doubt about the Four Noble Truths, then one's view is perfect. You know, one has got a complete understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So one has to be at least a Sotapanna at that stage, at least. Could be higher. So what the Buddha is saying, of course, is that Mahapajatami Gotami is like a Sotapanna. She's become an Aryan. Maybe soon after she took refuge, after she took the five precepts, and then attained stream entry, the Sotapatti, the first level of enlightenment. And it's interesting, if she were in fact a nun at this stage, one of the commentator on the comparative study of the Majjhima Nikaya, he says, if that were the case, you'd think the Buddha would mention the creation of the Bhikkhuni order, that the benefit he'd given her was to allow her to go forth. So that is an interesting thought, because it does make it seem like, well, maybe she was a lay person. But then Venerable Nalio, the author of this comparative study, says that, you know, maybe the Buddha was pointing out the major, the most important things, you know, like when she became a Buddhist and when she became a Sotapanna, you know, these very important things. Becoming a bhikkhuni is quite important too, but maybe she hadn't attained final knowledge, complete enlightenment, become an arahant at that stage. So now the Buddha continues with the different kinds of personal offerings. So he talks now about personal offerings, offerings to individuals, and then to offerings to the Sangha. And all versions of the sutta in Chinese and in the Tibetan, they talk about these in a similar way, but sometimes in a different order. Sometimes they talk about the offerings to the Sangha first in the Majjhima, Agama. They talk about the offerings to the Sangha first and then the personal offerings. And so the order can vary. Yeah. But to me, it seems more logical to deal with the personal offerings, because here's Mahapajatami Gotami. She's offering personally to the Buddha. So he's explaining to her why, you know, it's a greater merit to offer it to the Sangha, with himself at the head of the Sangha. There are 14 kinds of personal offerings, Ananda. One gives a gift to the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened. This is the first kind of personal offering. So this is the one that Mahapajatami Gotami is doing at this stage. One gives a gift to a Pacheka Buddha. This is the second kind of personal offering. And the Tathagata, of course, is the Buddha, but the Pacheka Buddha, for those that don't know, is a fully enlightened person who doesn't teach, though. They become enlightened, but they don't teach other people. And they say that a Pacheka Buddha only arises after a Sammasambuddha, like the Buddha of this era, his teachings have completely disappeared, then Pacheka Buddhas come, but they don't teach. But it's interesting, if you read, you know, the Jatakas and things like that, people go and make offerings to these Pacheka Buddhas, and, you know, so they must have spoken to them and received some sort of indication that these were very special beings, you know. So that's interesting. And here they're making offerings to Pacheka Buddha. And then the third type is one gives a gift to an arahant disciple of the Tathagata, of the Buddha. And this is the third kind of personal offering. And one gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of arahantship. This is the fourth kind of personal offering. And this is the one who has entered on the way, we say the path, isn't it, to becoming an arahant. They're not an arahant yet, but they're on the way. And you probably know from the Itipiso that the eight kinds of beings are usually those that are on the path to a stage of enlightenment, and those that actually have attained that enlightenment. And then the next one is, one gives a gift to a non-returner. This is... One gives a gift to a non-returner. This is the fifth kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of non-return. So this is anagami. This is the second highest level of enlightenment. So we're going out, aren't we? We're moving down from the top of the highest level of giving, personal offerings, to going down and down. This is still very high. This is the sixth kind of personal offering. And then one gives a gift to a once-returner. This is a sakadagami, the second stage of enlightenment. This is the seventh kind of personal offering. Or one gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of once return. This is the eighth kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to a stream enterer. This is the ninth kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of stream entry. And there's a footnote there, and it's an interesting thing because, you know, one would contemplate, how do you know somebody's on their way to the fruit of stream entry? You know, that's quite interesting. And I think the commentary says that anybody that is practicing the Noble Eightfold Path can be generally thought of as going towards walking the path that will lead to stream entry. But I have a feeling that it is actually more of a more advanced state than that. Maybe one is has a more insight than just having started walking the Noble Eightfold Path. So so that's interesting. Because the others, you know, well, then if you have attained stream entry, then you know you're likely to be on the path to once returner, and so on. But how do you know that you're about to attain stream entry? That's quite an interesting thought, speculation. So this is the tenth kind of offering. One gives a gift to one outside the dispensation who is free from lust for sensual pleasures. And this is like someone who's able to obtain jhana, isn't it? Having let go of sensual pleasures, they can attain jhana, and they can actually even be reborn in Brahma realms, if they're free of lust for sensual pleasures. So this is quite a high degree of spiritual training, and you would imagine, wouldn't you, that some of the Hindu sadhus and other traditions, maybe they have reached this sort of attainment. And we see this with some of the Christian saints too. I think, you know, there's obviously some degree of quite a high degree of attainment to reach this stage.
Would there be different sort of areas of jhana? Because say you're a Christian and you had that right view.
Oh, that's interesting. Would you go into the same... Would people from different religious backgrounds and traditions like St. Teresa, would they experience the jhana in the same way as others, like Buddhists? When they're reborn. That's interesting. Because they don't have a view that's a Buddhist view. What would their rebirth be, having attained, say, jhana in this life? Yes, exactly, you know. So, you know, I don't know of any... Buddha never spoke about that. But I would surmise that people like Christians, Muslims and so on can experience heavenly rebirths, can't they? But I think the way they experience that heavenly rebirth would be in terms of their own perceptions. So they would probably see heaven in a different way from what Buddhists would see it, but it would still be a heavenly existence. Except that, you know, a Buddhist would know, should know, this is not going to last forever. So that would be the big difference, I think. But I think a lot of these experiences of heavenly worlds and the Brahma worlds, mind-made, aren't they? So the perceptions could match, that they experience would match their belief, their view. I can't see that it could be different, because they're expecting to find unity with God or some similar concept. That's probably what they'll experience, actually, or how they'll interpret it. So, yes. But they're in for a surprise if once that existence finishes and then reborn somewhere else, then, you know, they realise not eternal, it's not forever. It's not the final resting place. So. And that's the 11th kind of personal offering, the one to one who is free from lust for sensual pleasures. And as I say, this is quite a high attainment, isn't it? It really is. And one gives a gift to a virtuous ordinary person. This is the 12th kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to an immoral ordinary person. This is the 13th kind of personal offering. And one gives a gift to an animal. This is the 14th kind of personal offering. So the Buddha has given us, hasn't he, a range from the top to the very highest, from the Tathagata, from the giving to a Buddha, right down to giving to an animal. So it's a, sort of like a comprehensive view. And then the Buddha continues. Any questions about that list? Herein, Ananda, by giving a gift to an animal, the offering may be expected to repay 100-fold. And what the Buddha is saying here, isn't he, is that any gift will give a result, you know. And obviously the result will depend, as we talk about later, on the quality of the giver and the receiver, you know, the moral quality of the giver and the receiver. But any gift will have some, there will be some benefit. And he says it repays 100-fold. And when I read that, I always wondered what 100-fold meant. 100-fold what? And if you read the footnote here, it actually says it's 100-fold, the commentary says. It's 100-fold in terms of existences. So in 100 existences, one will be repaid for this gift to an animal. But, you know, I found that a little bit difficult to agree with. And I spoke to some of the other monks, and I think the more obvious meaning, isn't it? It's 100-fold of what you've offered. So if you offered a small amount of food to an animal, then you'd get 100-fold sort of nutriment in either in this life or in later lives. Something like that, I think. More in terms of the quantity of what you've given in this life. So that's how I would interpret it. Anybody got other comments on that? Because it is interesting to say when the Buddha says it repays 100-fold. You know, is it 100-fold lives or is it 100-fold the quantity-wise of what you've given? Because it seems like a lot of lies, especially when you get to later offerings that give incalculable and immeasurable results. I mean, does that mean, you know, you can have incalculable and immeasurable lives? I find that, hopefully not, if you're a Buddhist practitioner. Do a bit about the ending of suffering before that. Yes, Hugh? Oh, yeah, good.
Yeah, the 100 existences.
Yeah.
It gives long life, beauty, happiness, strength and intelligence.
Yeah.
It makes one free of agitation.
Agitation, right.
Like you get 100 lives.
Is that one or is that later?
1297.
It's 1297. Oh, right, uh-huh. So, I mean, that's what you get when you make an offering to the Sangha, isn't it? That's actually the translation of the blessing we give. You know, when we do that one Abhivandana Silis Nicham Vanda Panchayino Chattaro Chattaro Dhamma Vanno Ayu Vanno Sukhang Balang. So it's long life, Vanno beauty and Sukhang happiness and Balang strength, yes. So we do that. Not intelligence though, not mentioned in that chant anyway. So thank you for that, Hugh. That's good. But it's still talking about 100 existences, isn't it? Yeah, no, I still find that somewhat, you know, I think seems especially in this stage, it doesn't seem like 100 lives doesn't seem a big deal, but when you're talking about incalculable and immeasurable lives, then then it starts to get too phenomenal, I think. Yes, of course. If one did become enlightened during that time, then you sort of annul, don't you? All the karma, you annul a lot of karma, not all. You can't get rid of all of it that could have come to fruition, you know, particularly the weaker types of karma. But some karma, of course, even for an arahant, will ripen, won't it? So we have Venerable Mahamoggallana, when he was beaten to death, even though he was an arahant, he had to experience the kama vipaka of having killed his parents in a previous life. So arahant is not exempt from some of his kama, but a lot of it is actually, once they attain enlightenment, won't fruit. But that was a very strong kama, so it came. The vipaka came. Right. I think that can be part of it, yes, can be part of it, because giving, there's a lot to giving, isn't it? There is a great deal of it. But the Buddha here is not actually talking about the motivation behind that. But if you look in the Anguttara Nikaya, there are two sets of two suttas where the Buddha talks about the reasons for giving. And they range from, very basic motivations, including things like giving out of fear, giving because somebody else, you know, this other person has already given me a gift, or thinking this person will give me a gift, so I'd better give them a gift, or thinking things like giving is good, ranging up into thinking that, you know, giving is good karma and I would experience good results in the future, this life, or potentially in future lives, a heavenly rebirth. Or, you know, thinking at a higher level is thinking, oh, that when I give, that brings happiness to me, brings joy to me. And then the Buddha said the highest one is that when one gives, one thinks that this ennobles and adorns the mind, like a jewel, actually. So that range, there's a whole range, you know. And there's another list where he talks about some of the lower reasons for it. You know, one can give out of attachment, out of, what does he call it? Like attachment, yes. Or out of fear, out of anger even, out of moha, you know, delusion. Many reasons. So he's not actually telling us what the motivation is here. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good point, because if one is giving, when one gives and it's reducing that sense of ego, I think it's actually doing the work that's intended by giving. Because isn't it, dana is the first thing that the Buddha emphasised in terms of training, you know, dana and then sila and then bhavana, you know, meditation. So it is very important, actually, because it opens us up and actually, as you say, reduces the ego. So we've just given to an animal, and by giving a gift to an immoral ordinary person, the offering may be expected to repay a thousandfold. So that's quite significant too. Quite a lot. And by giving to a virtuous ordinary person, the offering may be expected to repay 100,000-fold. So that would be like, you know, giving to someone who's keeping 5 precepts, 8 precepts, 10 precepts. And you notice in Buddhist countries, particularly for the Anagarikas, they will, I see this in Sri Lanka, they will make offerings to the monks, and they also offer the food to the Anagarikas too. Because they see that, you know, these men are in training, a higher training than we are. You know, they may be taking 5 precepts. So it's appreciating the level of moral development or intention to develop morality to that level. And then by giving a gift to one outside the dispensation who is free from lust for sensual pleasures, the offering may be expected to repay 100,000 times 100,000-fold. So it's getting, I think that's a million, I think it says. That's quite a lot. That's extraordinary. Good question, Lynn. How does one know if someone is free from lust? You can really only know, can't you, if you have quite a close association with them and see them in situations where you might expect lust to arise, you know, desire to arise when they're offered something that's very tempting or, you know. So that would be the only way that you could really know. If someone was supposed to be free of anger, that's more easy to know, isn't it? And that's often the test for if somebody thinks they're an arahant, what do? You try to make them angry. If they get angry, then they think, oh, can't be an arahant. So, but with somebody who's free from lust, it's harder to determine that. But I suppose the way you could do it is offering something that would be considered very enticing, very attractive and agreeable, and then seeing the result, seeing if they actually were taken in by that. I think that would possibly be the way. But harder to see, yeah. I think there's a question from on the internet, so we can have a look. Oh, yeah. Ah, righto. And the first question is, I'll just read these now. How does karma fruit for fully enlightened beings? Well, and that's a long question to go into, and the commentaries have their idea about functional kiriya karma, that a lot of the karma doesn't ripen for an arahant, for a fully enlightened being. Because, as I said, quite a lot of karma actually drops away when one becomes fully enlightened. They call that ahosi karma, I think, like a past karma. And so for an enlightened... But as I just mentioned, you know, they're not exempt from very strong karma, are they? So the Venerable Mahamoggallana was beaten to death and died from that, passed into parinibbana from that. Oh, it continues, actually, this goes on. Aha. Uh-huh. Are they not freed from all past karma? No, can't be. It says, are they not freed from all past karma? If that were the case, then, Venerable Mahamoggallana wouldn't have to have experienced that death like that, would he? And so I think, no, they're not free from all past karma. But it has to be really strong karma that will fruit regardless, you know, of whether one's become enlightened. The difference being, of course, that once one has attained arahantship, the way one experiences this past karma will be in a much more detached way, you know, not like for most people, well, for everyone actually, being beaten to death would be incredibly painful, incredible suffering, and I'm sure it was physical suffering for Venerable Mahamoggallana, but knowing that these five khandhas, this body and mind, are not self, they're just causally arisen, he could stand back probably, and though the pain was there was no mental suffering. And so the body could pass away peacefully in the mind, even though severe pain, racking pain. And they go into great detail and they say that every bone in his body was broken, so they make it sound very horrendous. And it says, why are enlightened beings not freed from past karma? Well, they are freed once they enter parinibbana, of course, it's finished. It's done with. But only, as far as I understand, the karma that they're not free from is the very strong karma, you know, that will ripen regardless, you know, like killing your parents. There are other ones, causing a schism, I think, in the Sangha and so on. There's five of them. So I hope that's answered your question. Yeah. That's very readable too. Thanks. Thank you. That's a very good, thank you for that, Lynn. That's a very, very good point. Yes, the ordinary person who is virtuous could be a member of the Sangha or could be a lay person, yes. I mentioned 5 precepts, 10 precepts, but it's also monks and nuns that haven't attained, yes, very much. That's correct. Outside the dispensation means outside Buddhist, say, religion. Yeah, in other traditions like Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, and so on. And India at that time, many, many different religions. So, yes, that's a very good point. And, you know, when we have offerings to the monks and nuns, you probably heard the chant that they have a special chant. Don't always do it, but where they offer it to the Sangha, and it's often it mentions the fact that they're offering it to beings that are possess sila, silavanta. So, and that's an important qualification, because we know that if you offer it to someone who has who is practicing a good level of morality, then it's much more fruitful, much more benefit, that offering. And also you're offering it with a sense that that person may well become enlightened. They're on the path to become enlightened, on the path to attain jhana, insight. So can be very inspiring for our own practice too. So thank you for that. That's good. That makes it more complete. So, and then the Buddha continues. Yes, by giving a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of stream entry, the offering may be expected to repay incalculably, immeasurably. What then should be said about giving a gift to a stream enterer? So now we've entered the range of immeasurable, incalculable. So it's just vast. So this is a gift to somebody that's entered upon the path to stream entry, and then a stream enterer. And sometimes, you know, people might say, for instance, one who's entered on the path to stream entry is like a sadhanusari, wouldn't they, or a dhammanusari. So this is someone who has got a lot of faith. Obviously, they understand the Dhamma well, a sadhanusari. And a dhammanusari is one that's got a lot of understanding and faith in the Dhamma, good, deep understanding of the Dhamma. And they're often seen as precursors, aren't they, to becoming a sotapanna, attaining sotapatti. So a faith, I think they're usually translated as faith follower and a Dhamma follower. But these are quite high levels before sotapanna. So we continue. What should be said about a gift to one who has entered on the way to the realization of the fruit of one's return, or to a once returner, to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of non-return, to a non-returner, to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of arahantship, to an arahant and to a Pacheka Buddha? What should be said about one about giving a gift to a Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened? So we have a scale that's gradually increasing benefit and merit. And just have a look at the... Oh, no, dear. Uh-huh. All right, yes. It's saying that the incalculable and immeasurable is like a scale that it increases, so it's going up. So it's quite an interesting idea. So they are the 14 kinds of personal gifts that one can make, and the degree of benefit that is derived from it. So obviously giving to a Tathagata is the highest. And now we talk about the offerings to the Sangha. And it says here, the Buddha says, continues, there are seven kinds of offering made to the Sangha, Ananda. One gives to a Sangha of both, and then it says, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, in brackets, headed by the Buddha. And here you might notice that it says both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. And if, in fact, Mahapajapati Gotami was only a layperson at this time, this would not fit, wouldn't it? Because she was the first person, she asked for ordination, going forth, from the Buddha. And she was the first person, the first woman, to become a samaneri and then a bhikkhuni. So, become a bhikkhuni, actually. This would be an anachronism if that were the case. If she were a layperson, how could there be a bhikkhuni sangha? So this supports the idea I said earlier that one of the translations in the... I think it was in the Tibetan, actually, says that she's actually already a nun. Yes, it's the individual Chinese translation. there is in it like the Majjhima Agama translation, and then there's a separate translation, another translation that was also made in Chinese, and it says in that, it's the only one that says she's a nun. The others don't comment on it. And I gather too, even the commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya doesn't comment on it. So either they thought it was so obvious, or they didn't question that maybe she was already a nun, because they would have read this and thought, well, if she weren't a nun, then how could there be bhikkhunis? You know, which is quite reasonable actually to ask. They would, yeah. You would expect actually that the venerable Mahapajatami, Gotami, true. Yeah, that's what I would expect actually. And other suttas that deal with bhikkhunis, I think maybe you would see that actually, because the one Venerable Nandika, the avada that Venerable Nandika gave to the bhikkhunis, I'm pretty sure it says venerable there. So you would expect that actually. I think that's quite true. And also you might say, you know, that one translation out of about three or four is probably not so reliable. But it's interesting to reflect on that, because, you know, it would fit with the sutta then if it were the case. Anyway. So that's an offering to the both Sangha, the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis, headed by the Buddha. This is the first kind of offering made to the Sangha. And then one gives a gift to a Sangha. Just check the footnote for that one to see if... Yes. It says that this gift is... there is no equal to, in measure, to this gift. This is the kind of gift that Mahapajapati Gotami would be giving in offering the pair of cloths. And then one gives a gift to a Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis after the Tathagata has attained final Nibbana. So this is like the next level. And this is actually what we find these days. It's possible to give to bhikkhus and bhikkhunis again. So this is very nice that it's possible to do this again. So this is the second kind of offering made to the Sangha. And then one gives a gift to a Sangha of bhikkhus. One wonders too with this list whether it's sort of like from the highest to the lowest. That, you know, offering to the Sangha, both Sanghas with the Buddha, maybe that's the highest. And then offering to both Sanghas after the Buddha has passed into Parinibbana, next highest, maybe. So one offers a gift to the Sangha of bhikkhus. This is the third kind of offering made to the Sangha. And then one gives a gift to a Sangha of bhikkhunis. This is the fourth kind of offering made to the Sangha. So separating the two Sanghas. One gives a gift, saying, appoint so many bhikkhus and bhikkhunis for me from the Sangha. This is the fifth kind of offering made to the Sangha. This sort of request would be quite often made if you were inviting monks and nuns to meals, I would imagine. That's the sort of thing they would ask for so many monks from a monastery or so many nuns. I don't know if they'd both go at the same time. I suppose they must. Or one gives a gift saying, appoint so many bhikkhus for me from the Sangha. This is the sixth kind of offering made to the Sangha. Or one gives a gift saying, appoint so many bhikkhunis for me from the Sangha. This is the seventh kind of offering made to the Sangha. So I think there may be sort of a hierarchy with that. It seems to me, particularly you would think, offering to the Sangha, both Sanghas, with the Buddha at the head of those two Sanghas, would be the most merit, actually. So any comments about that list? And I should say here that in the other translations, they do mention, I think most of them mention bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. So obviously they all agree that we're talking about offerings to the Bhikkhu Sangha and the Bhikkhuni Sangha. So, you know, it does imply that Mahapajatami Gotami must have been a nun by that stage, because she's generally accepted as being the first woman to be ordained, gone forth into the holy life. And then we continue. This is quite an interesting one. This, in future times, Ananda, there will be members of the clan who are yellow necks, not rednecks, yellow necks, immoral, of evil character. People will give gifts to those immoral persons for the sake of the Sangha. Even then, I say, an offering made to the Sangha is incalculable, immeasurable. And I say that in no way does a gift to a person individually ever have greater fruit than an offering made to the Sangha. And that's quite an amazing comment about members of the clan who are yellow necks. And according to the footnote, it's that they had these yellow cloths tied around their necks or arms, and that they supported wives and children by engaging in trading and farming. Interesting. Yes. And it's interesting too in this comparative study that it points out that quite a few of them don't have, well, most of them don't have this offering to members of the clan. These would be monks of immoral or evil character. They don't have that. And the Madhyama Agama, actually, what they have instead of immoral evil character, they say that this is like a monk who doesn't have energy. He's not energetic, so not practicing. So they don't put an ethical qualifier about this sort of person. But they say then it will be still of great benefit because it's offering to the Sangha. But Venerable Analia, the author of the comparative study, he says that in many, many places the Buddha said, actually, that the quality of the receiver is very important, that they should be morally qualified, as it were, well, you know, practicing well their sila, their morality. So it does seem a bit of a strange one that such an offering to these immoral, evil characters on behalf of the Sangha could actually be of such great fruit. But of course, as the footnote points out, that the intention of the giver is very important and can purify the gift. But as I just mentioned, you know, certainly the Buddha emphasized that when the receiver should be pure, often he mentioned the receiver should be pure. And Venerable Nalio suggests, it's an idea, that this section here may be a later addition. And it's possible. And he says perhaps because, you know, some monks in, at that time, that this was maybe inserted, not practicing very well, not keeping their sila very well, so they wanted to ensure that they were still supported and made a case for the that it is, because you're giving it to the Sangha, it brings great fruit. That's possible. It is possible that that could be the case. And the commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya, so the commentary to this sutta, it in a way this makes it even more strange. It says that giving to an individual arahant is of less merit than giving to immoral, evil monks, but giving that to, on the, who are accepting that gift on behalf of the Sangha. I find that very hard to believe. So the commentary is saying that if you're giving to the Sangha, no matter what quality that Sangha is or the recipients you're giving it to, it's greater merit than giving to an arahant. And when you read that, you sort of think, well, is that possible? I find that very, very hard to believe. And Venerable Nalio says because of that and the fact that it's not mentioned, this the immoral, evil characters, these monks, not mentioned in some of the other translations, that it's possibly a later edition. So it could be. Because it does seem a bit strange, that one. So we continue. Any more questions about that? And the Buddha makes it very strong, puts it very strongly when he says, doesn't he? And I say that in no way does a gift to an individual, a person individually, ever have greater fruit than an offering made to the Sangha. And maybe this is why the commentary puts up this case, which, even though hard to believe, probably has its justification from this comment by the Buddha. And as we discussed, as Lynn asked earlier, why is this so? And I suggested, and this is only my own idea, that it's because when you give to the Sangha, you usually give to the Sangha the present and the future, those to come. And so it's like incremental benefits. So as if you've given to a Sangha like a kuti, then it will be used by many, many monks or many, many nuns. And so benefit, the merit, keeps increasing. And then the Buddha continues and talks about how the gifts purify. And this is a very important section, isn't it? And he says, there are four kinds of purification of offering. What for? And when we talk of purification, I think here the commentary says that the purification actually means that it's of great benefit, great merit. And so this actually ensures the power, the strength of the merit, offering. Yes, it says it's made fruitful, so it's more fruitful. There is the offering that is purified by the receiver, not by the giver. There is the offering that is purified neither by the giver nor the receiver. There is the offering that is purified by both the both by the giver and by the receiver. So this shows us that it's a twofold process, and maybe you could even say that, say, an offering to these yellow-necked monks in future times, could be construed that if the giver has got a pure motivation, then it could be a great merit, great benefit to them. And I think that would always be the case, because if they're giving with such a good heart, then I think they would benefit from it. So, and the Buddha continues. And what is the offering that is purified by the giver, not by the receiver? Here, the giver is virtuous, of good character, and the receiver is immoral, of evil character. Thus, the offering is purified by the giver, not by the receiver. And as I said, this could be very much the case with these yellow necks that have this patch of yellow cloth. Presumably, I've heard some traditions they have little patches of cloth, and they have like the paddy field design on it. And maybe it's something like this that the Buddha's referring to, actually. So it's sort of like an emblem, a reminder of the Buddha. And And what is the offering that is purified neither by the giver nor the receiver? Here the giver is immoral, of evil character, and the receiver is immoral, of evil character. Thus the offering is purified neither by the giver nor the receiver. One wonders why somebody would give, given that case, they were immoral and of evil character, because you'd think there wouldn't be much motivation to do it, unless they thought they were going to get some benefit from it, I guess. So that's where it's purified neither by the giver nor the receiver. And what is the offering that is purified both by the giver and by the receiver? Here the giver is virtuous, of good character, and the receiver is virtuous, of good character. Thus the offering is purified both by the giver and by the receiver. These are the four kinds of purification of offering. And of course, you know, when lay people offer to monks and nuns, they are offering to them usually with a sense of that they are of good character, moral, and of good character, practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. And of course, many of the lay people they're offering are also, you know, very a lot of integrity and practicing quite hard themselves. So in that case, it's doubly blessed. You could say it was insured to have good results. And part of that offering too is, you know, when you do make offerings, it's like an inspiration for your practice too, because not only, I know often people think of making merit for future lives, you know, to develop, to have heavenly rebirth, but also for our practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. It can be a real inspiration to see monks, nuns, lay people, Kalyana Mittas, that are practicing well. It really, you know, really gives us an incentive to practice and to get a lot of joy and happiness. Because, as I said, most of this, I've said this weekend, it's really the example that counts. You know, often the words can be good, but if the example's not good, then it really undercuts it. So if there's a good example as well, then people really feel inspired. It's like a model for how to develop the path. And then we conclude the sutta with some nice verses, and this is, that is what the Blessed One said. When the Sublime One said that, the teacher said further. Are there any questions about that last section about purifying the gift?
Just before. What is this word purify? What does it mean to purify? To make it legitimate, or
Yes, good question. What is purifying? When we talk about purifying the gift, what do we mean by purifying? And as I said, the commentary says, you know, that it's making what it makes it more fruitful. It makes it more powerful. But purifying certainly doesn't it? It has the idea that that one's conduct, moral conduct, is pure. You know, and it has that quality for me. That's how it's purifying. I think purifying more in the sense of reducing negativity, increasing the positive. Yeah, yeah. No, good question. I think it's so. The Buddha concludes with some verses. When a virtuous person to an immoral person gives, with trusting heart, a righteous gift, righteously obtained gift. Placing faith that the fruit of action is great, the giver's virtue purifies the offering. So here is somewhat of an answer to what you asked you, which is, you know, about purification. So when a virtuous person gives to an immoral person. And interesting, you know, trusting heart can be quite a strong term. In English it seems pretty mild, you know, we could gloss over that, but in another sutta, the Velama Sutta, which is also on giving and the scale of giving, it says that for one with a trusting heart, greater merit than giving to the Sangha with the Buddha at the head of that Sangha, which is very high merit, even giving a monastery, greater merit than that is one who has a trusting heart, takes refuge, and then one with a trusting heart that takes the five precepts. And one with a trusting heart that develops loving kindness for the time that it takes to pull a cow's udder. I think we're talking about very high level of loving kindness, metta. It's more like, I think, liberation of the mind through metta. And then the last one, the highest one, greater merit than giving to the Buddha and the Sangha, is developing the perception of impermanence for the snap of the fingers. And I think that's the sort of perception that a Sotapanna gets when they see that all that is of the nature to arise is of the nature to cease. So it must be, you know, they're very high levels of merit. So they're greater than giving to the Buddha and the Sangha. So practice, you know, obviously the Buddha is saying there that practice is really the greatest merit. So trusting with a trusting heart is actually quite a key term. It'd be interesting to see what the Pali says, actually. And a righteously obtained gift that's righteously obtained is a good qualifier, because you can think sometimes people might give something they've stolen, it's not their property, or some other obtained in some way that's illegal or not ethical, unethical. And in placing faith that the fruit of action is great, so this person, you know, they have right view, don't they, that there is a result from all our, there are results that arise, vipaka, that arises from all our intentional actions, which we're making moment by moment. It's happening all the time. So that it points to a level of right view. Then it says the giver's virtue purifies the offering. So really, Hugh, that's qualifying what purify means. So it's taking into account quite a few mental factors there. And then when an immoral person to a virtuous person gives with an untrusting heart a gift unrighteously obtained, nor places faith that the fruit of action is great, the receiver's virtue purifies the offering. That's amazing, isn't it? Because it means that even if you don't believe in karma, you get the result of it, you know. So that's good news, actually, for a lot of people that don't have an idea of the results of actions. And so they're giving to somebody who's a virtuous person, maybe a lay person or a monk or a nun, and not necessarily with a trusting heart, not necessarily with a lot of faith in karma, but then it has it's purified by the recipient, the receiver. So, and any comments about that one? That's quite an interesting one, I think. So it means that people can, as it were, do something very good, even that they don't have... You'd think, wouldn't you, their motivation, their attitude, probably not good, and yet it can have great fruit, great benefit. So,
For the immoral person?
For the immoral person, yeah. It's quite extraordinary. You know, they may be giving... Well, who knows what their reason would be for giving if they didn't have a trusting heart. Maybe they're just doing it for, because it was expected, or they thought they might get a good reputation is another reason the Buddha said people give, you know, because people say, he gives, you know, and so on. So it could be some negative, as it were, motivation there, but it's still purified by the receiver's virtue. So very good. And then when an immoral person to an immoral person gives with untrusting heart a gift unrighteously obtained, nor places faith that the fruit of action is great, neither's virtue purifies the offering. And that would be, that's quite understandable, in which case it doesn't bring any benefit to either of them, or little. I think giving always has benefit, but much less benefit.
Yeah, because the good heart is not developed in either of them.
That's correct, yes. And,
so they're down on the ground, as it were, as though being, knowing what's more noble in giving.
Exactly, yeah. Yes, Hugh, I think that shows they definitely haven't got that highest form of reason for giving, you know, that ennobles and adorns the mind. Definitely not. They've got one of the lower reasons, either giving out of fear or out of attachment, or giving out of anger, or giving out of delusion or stupidity. Yeah. Could be any of those reasons, actually. And the next one is, when a virtuous person to a virtuous person gives with trusting heart a gift righteously obtained, placing faith that the fruit of action is great, that gift, I say, will come to full fruition. So that is obviously the optimum situation, where the person is virtuous and obviously practicing virtue, and the recipient is also virtuous and practicing that the virtue that they have. So that would be, giving to anyone that is practicing a level of virtue. And the higher the level of virtue they're practicing, you would presume the greater the merit that would derive from that. That's interesting. But he says full fruition, doesn't he? Full fruition, that's quite strong. So... And the last one is, when a passionless person to a passionless person gives with trusting heart a gift righteously obtained, placing faith that the fruit of action is great, that gift, I say, is the best of worldly gifts. And that one, of course, a passionless person usually interpreted as an arahant, And the footnote says that it's a gift from an arahant to an arahant. And that arahant believes, obviously, in the fruit of karma. They don't believe, they know it. And because he is without desire and lust for existence, his own act of giving is not productive of any fruits. It is mere functional action, which we mentioned before, kiriya, that leaves no traces behind. But as we mentioned before, some karma, obviously very, very strong karma, cannot be avoided, and arahants even have to experience it. So this would be the highest form of worldly giving from one enlightened person to another enlightened person. That's interesting. So this is the exposition on giving, and it gives you an idea of this scale, doesn't it? The scale of giving to the various individuals, and the highest being to the Buddha, to the Tathagata, the fully enlightened, ranging down to the animal, and then the offerings to the Sangha. Often the highest seems to be to the both Sanghas, the Bhikkhuni Sangha and the Bhikkhu Sangha, with the Buddha at the head of those Sanghas. And then the next one being the offering to the Bhikkhu and Bhikkhuni Sangha after the passing of the Buddha, the Tathagata. So they're all very high levels of merit being made, and great power to those gifts. And that's, as I say, that's quite interesting when you go down to the last one, the immoral and evil characters, whether these monks, whether that's part of the original sutra or a later edition, it's hard to say, but interesting to speculate. So, and quite nicely, even though this sutra doesn't end with it, the individual Chinese translation actually ends with Maha Pajatami Gotami, offering the robes to the Sangha. When I read that, I thought, well, that is very appropriate. It brings it together. So, and that would make a lot of sense because she's just heard the Buddha's explanation and has realised, yes, this would be the most appropriate thing. So if there are any questions or comments people have about offering. Oh, there's some more questions, I think. Couple is there, yeah. Oh, that's right, that's good. And then we can finish off. Because it's an important area, you know, because we talk about dana, and it's good to know a lot of details, the detail of dana, so that when we give, we have a good understanding of the results of our giving, but also the fact that how we should give in a way to make it of more merit, you know, and to have a good heart, as Hugh was talking about and I was talking about this weekend, in giving is very important. And to maintain that good intention when we before we give, when we give, and after we give, because sometimes the intention can change, can't it? And in some cases, people give and then they regret it later, and that sort of reduces, undermines a lot of the value of that giving, you know. And there are examples in the Dhammapada commentary of people that have given to a Buddha, or a Pacheka Buddha in this case, and given, and then later thought, oh, I should have saved it for the family and the workers. And what they experienced in a later life was that they had fabulous wealth, enormous wealth, but couldn't enjoy it. So going around in rags and a terrible old cart, eating very rough food, and they couldn't enjoy it. And I think maybe in that case the king actually ends up confiscating all the wealth because no heir. And so that would be the sort of result for somebody who regrets what they've given. So it's important we maintain that attitude, that intention of giving, and the quality of it is very good. Oh. Oh, right. No, if you don't give, no. Then Buddha never, yes, yeah. Yeah, you don't give. I don't think so, because never mentions that, actually. It just mentions when you do give and then you've got mixed motivation, or your motivation is good. But not to give, I don't think, is in itself bad karma. But of course, you know, there could be mental aspects to it, can't there? You know, like there could be negative states of mind. I won't give, in like an angry state of mind, gives rise to some karma, is strengthening karma vipaka as a result of, you know, to do with anger. You know, so one would experience some negative results from that in the future. Maybe the most obvious result will be that one will continue to be, say, angry, you know, reinforce that anger. And so the question, one of the questions here, if giving to righteous, to a righteous person is purified, would that mean if one has to commit a robbery, steal, etc., would give it to the Sangha, would that be good karma for them? Well, we just mentioned that the in those verses where the Buddha actually says, and probably the person asked this question before that, that a righteously obtained gift, he's talking about a righteously obtained gift. But, you know, so he's actually discounting things that, you know, people have committed robberies for, or steal or take from other people and then offer to the Sangha. So would that be good karma? Interesting. It would. I think it would. Yes, it would depend, wouldn't it? I would think it's not great karma because it's not theirs to give, not theirs to offer. But they may have a very good mind state about the giving. Obviously, a negative mind state about having obtained it by the wrong means. But I would think that it's not of such good karma. Because the Buddha does mention righteously obtained in those last verses and emphasises that. So, you know, that wouldn't be such good karma. I can't imagine it would be. And I think that's the last question for this afternoon, so I think that's more than enough. And so maybe we can finish by paying respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. And thank you very much for coming this afternoon. And I think this completes the theme of, well, it probably doesn't complete, we've got to practice it and develop it for ourselves. So good, we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha.